good afternoon. We're back here on this Monday, February 11th, 2019. And this hour, we are going to have a lot of fun because we are going to talk about an event that gathers people around their television and radios this coming Sunday. This coming Sunday is the 40th anniversary of the televised Great American Race, the Daytona 500, the NASCAR series race that kicks off the season in a very big way. 40 years on television, 60 years the race has been going on. Now, here's the interesting thing. 40 years ago, CBS Television, 1979, the man who broadcast the first race and did so through 1997 and coined the term the Great American Race is joining us right now, the dean of NASCAR broadcasters, really any kind of racing broadcasting, the legend Ken Squire. Ken, how are you?
I'm trying to remember the legend. I'm having trouble with that, but I'll accept the rest. Yes, thank you very much. Tis I. What temperature is it in Ohio right now?
It's about 32.
Oh, it's only about 19 here, so we're chattering a little, but we'll make it through.
Ken, this is going to be a lot of fun. I do want to let people know that the 60th running of the Daytona 500 will be coming up on Sunday, 2 p.m. on the Fox Network. It is the 60th running, 40th running on television. You were involved in 1979 when this first went on television. Tell us how that all came to be.
Well, by that time, I think I'd been at CBS about 5 years. And did a series of things, part of which became the NFL halftime show. And I did a lot of feature work, kind of a traveling sports program that didn't particularly get into what was considered major league. And I was having a grand time. And one of the members of the cast of that show was from Philadelphia. And at that point, CBS had no interest in motorsports particularly, but they liked the idea of folks from outside in the country and not just city folks. So they said, oh, yeah, we've got that strange person from Vermont. And there I was, and gave me the opportunity to produce some, which I relished. That was really terrific, and talk about some things that I really enjoyed. So, we were off and running, but as you say, actually we were doing some races before that, but nothing of the size and order of the Great American Race. So, we had a chat with them and told them why we thought that the thing was representative of so much of America and didn't get played very well. And in fact, most of what was being done was kind of negative to what motorsports was and could be. And they bought into that, and they went down to look at Daytona in 1977. Negotiations went on for a while, and by golly, we got it done. And in 79, flag to flag, it was on the net, the Tiffany of the television at that time, CBS. And they gave us every bit of cooperation one could hope for to get that first broadcast on. Well, then the weatherman didn't help when we got down to the day of the race, and almost didn't make air. It rained in Daytona. Everybody was set and ready to go. And they said, well, if it rains for an hour or so, we won't do it. Well, we convinced them that no matter what, there were some reasons to do it, and some were from the commercial side. And away we went. We got it started. But the big thing was that they had elected, if they were going to do something like that, and they had really looked at it with the thought of it was something different that was wholesome and fit in with what they really liked to do. They had some real difficulties with a lot of what racing was, mostly because of fatalities and so forth, and they didn't want that. Well, we got it on, finally, and that day it rained for an hour and a half in the morning, and we thought we might be swamped. Next thing we knew, as Bill France had told us, it would clear at a certain hour, and indeed, luck of Bill France just flowed over the Daytona 2.5 mile track and got it started. In fact, the first few laps were run under caution to make sure they had really got the track dry, and they had the best system for doing that with 43 cars that were in the race. I think there were a couple more. I have to look that up. I think it's 45, 46. And we were off to the races.
Mm. What do you?
Strangely enough, that race was like something scripted. Went so long, and then bingo, the drama would commence, and then from there develop to the end of the program. Kaylee Yarborough, Donnie Allison, they had gotten together very early in the race, got snarled up. Next thing we knew, they were snuggled in the infield and went down a couple of laps. They got out of the infield. The infield by that time was a mess. It was a rainy time, and they couldn't get traction, so forth and so on. So you had two of the key players at that time coming out of the back of the field. And meanwhile, A.J. Foyt, Richard Petty, and that obstreperous new young figure, that was Darrell Waltrip, were up front putting on a heck of a show. So one show was Donnie and Cale, and the other was a super-duper race for the lead. That transpired for the rest of the day and made for pretty interesting television. And, of course, with Richard Petty and Cale Yarborough, folks like that, you had the best of the best going at it, hammer and tong.
Mm.
By the end, Donnie Allison, he'd worked his way back to the lead lap. And who did he find there? Cale Yarborough, who'd come along as well. So you had another story as they clipped their way from being laps down into the lead in that event. And we were following that very carefully. And in its conclusion, with a few laps to go, they met for the lead. And they both were not going to give up any opportunity to win the Great American Race, which created a situation where the racing was as exciting and thrilling as one could ever hope for. The two of them just dogging each other, trying to find a way to get by and get away from the other. Didn't work. It was as if they were galvanized together. So you know the rest of the story.
Now, Ken,
they came.
Oh, go ahead.
Down to that last lap, and there was no give on anyone's part. They both absolutely positively thought they were going to win that show. So it was terrific. Just a wonderful event to follow. And it lasted, 3.5 hours? And America had sort of tuned in. Some of them were sort of caught in the winter snows up north. But generally speaking, it was just a heck of a good race. And CBS had wasted no time in coming to the position of wanting to make it look as good as anything they'd ever done. And at that time, they had done the Gulf like nobody had ever done it. And they were doing NFL football. And there we were with the kind of personnel that makes all the difference. And they did just a bang-up job that day. And then, to finish it off, Cale and Donnie, they did a bang-up job on each other in that final moment of the race. Ended up, nobody was relenting. They were side by side into the backstretch, and the next thing you know, they were not only in the backstretch, but they were in the back wall. They walloped the darn thing and took themselves out, because that was the one race, the Daytona 500, that meant more than any other. If you're going to win a race, it was like Indianapolis, that's the one you wanted to watch and be on top of at the end. So we were very careful to keep the cameras all fired up and get the job done, and they gave us that spectacular finish, which was concluded about 20 seconds after the incident in turn three between Cale Yarborough and Donnie Allison, when three cars began to make themselves known. They were about, they were third, fourth, and fifth, made themselves known coming down out of the third and fourth turn that one of them was going to take the cake. They were just flying. And Richard Petty persevered over Darrell Waltrip. He came in second when the checkered flag fell, and there was A.J. Foyt, who had been waiting to make a move, and when he got ready to make a move, that car wasn't ready to go. So Richard Petty wins it in the final moments, and he was the high personality in the race. He represented, if you had to find the right athlete, that was Richard Petty. End of story.
Very interesting. Okay. Now, Ken, you being in the broadcast booth the first time that had been done, the running of the Daytona 500, do you have any memories of how the race was broadcast, how it was handled from the booth?
Well, it was, as you say, the first time out of the box for the Daytona 500. And there'd been a lot of television, and we had done some of it on a half-mile track in Asheville, Weaverville, that sort of thing. But this was putting it on where it really made a difference. And that's what happened. It did. And it was a fairly simple race to do because there was a battle for the lead all the way through the afternoon, and there was the additional drama of two of the better drivers fighting their way back up to the lead and getting there. So that sort of took care of itself, and what we had to do was follow the pictures and make sure we didn't wander off onto some side trail. And we had a lot of feature material that had been shot about these people. Not an intimate look, but a real look at who they were and what this race meant. Made all the difference in the world. But I don't think we did anything particularly different than what we'd do any other day, except we did it for a little longer period of time, and we had this just blockbuster of a sensational race in front of us.
You also coined the term the Great American Race. How did that come about?
Australia. We went to Australia, and while we were there to do another show, the Hardy Ferrodo race, which was sort of their Daytona. They love racing in Australia as much as we do in this country. And it was going to be on, and we were talking with the television folks over there who'd had quite a lot of experience with that race. And they said, well, you're here. Why don't you stay for next week and come up and see what happens when they run their big race of the year? Well, by golly, you weren't going to give up that kind of an opportunity. So we got to see the thing, and it was a much larger track. It was like 3.5 miles, and it was a road course, but it was specially made for a racetrack. And they were having a swell time. And in the midst of that, we found this strange group of Irish guys, young guys, that had this in-car camera. And and it worked. And you could look out the front of the car, race car, or spin it around, look out the back, and all of these kinds of things. It was pretty interesting. We hadn't seen that at that level ever before. And it was their big race. The banks closed, and all over Australia, it would have been like the Australia Cup in horse racing. So I was coming home and thinking about all that we had seen and all the care that had gone in to that race. And everybody's always saying it's the biggest race in the year and it's the most sensational. And they didn't do that. They just said it was their great race. Well, I thought, super duper, we can take, we'll bring something home and give people a great race. And we had one. We didn't have a name on it like that. But we had this spectacular event in Florida, which had history to it that went back to the beginning of the 20th century, where drivers had first come down to Daytona in February to race on the beach. And this was a variation on that theme. And it just seemed appropriate that instead of the greatest spectacle in sport, that was Indianapolis, and they'd worked hard on that one. But it needed something that set it off and didn't sound like fabulous, sensational, or any of that, just that it was one whale of a race. And it seemed that that would, might just fit right, the great American race. And the other part was, New York Times took us to task because in the course of the build-up to it, we'd done a feature about it, and said that it was just that and sort of spelled out why, but I guess I didn't do a good enough job. And they commented in an editorial column in the sports section that apparently CBS had not ever seen the Indianapolis 500. And au contraire, we'd not only seen it, we had grown up loving it. It was very, very special. And it was everything that they talked about is spectacular, and Indianapolis was the race, the greatest spectacle in sports, they called it. So how are you going to compete against the greatest spectacle in sport? Well, it seemed like a pretty good idea with a group of young American men and cars that all came from Detroit. They weren't built in foreign countries. Going the distance of 500 miles would make a great American race. American, oh, granted, there was always one or two Europeans that they brought in to run that show. But generally speaking, it was all about folks from everywhere you could think of, like Vermont or Ohio or Oregon or Washington. And this was their annual get-together. This was the one that everybody wanted. So why not be the great American race and forget about being the most anything? Leave it at that. Worked out pretty well.
You know, Ken, it's very interesting. 1979, the first time this was broadcast on television, 40 years ago. And at that time, the big things on television, sports-wise, that got ratings, the Indianapolis 500 was still a huge event in the 70s. Boxing was still a huge event on television in the 70s. And as the last 40 years have went on, the Indianapolis 500 is certainly not looked upon like it used to be, even here in the Midwest. Boxing certainly not looked on like it was in those days. But NASCAR, in my opinion, and I think most, is the only thing that has grown. Now it's covered on network. It's even left a lot of cable outlets and went to mainstream network. Why has it went upstream in the last 40 years when a lot of others have not?
Well, a lot of it was the genius of Bill France, and quite frankly, I think the Indianapolis 500 is going to be bigger and better than it ever has been. There's new management up there, and They're dealing with some issues that make that race far more interesting and fascinating than they were even at that time. But that one had the magic, the mysticism of the kind of race it was. And it was a thrill show, always. And it spoke to the American psyche of sport. It was a blood sport. CBS didn't like those kind of sports. They wouldn't do boxing. and heretofore they wouldn't do motorsports. And it was as much Darrell Waltrip who went with us up to New York and pleaded our case. And we said, look, this is the great event with these people that really represent America. They didn't come from foreign countries. The cars were American. And that got lost in the fact that it was a heck of a show, that the cars all came with names that were representative of Detroit. And the side of American industry that was the automobile, and we had a lot to do with it, the old United States, really was something that chimed with the American psyche, whereas the cars that were at Indianapolis, by that time, originally, many of them were made and produced here in the United States. But by that time, the basic names were Ford and Chevrolet and Plymouth and Pontiac, and go on from there. But assembled in America, driven by young guys that came back from World War II, had risked everything in 4 or 5 years over there in Europe and in Japan, and they were not coming home to mow the lawn. They weren't up for that at all, and they didn't play badminton very well, but by George, they could hammer a car. And all over America, these short tracks were developed, all kinds of strange promotions, and we began to develop a whole new group, a stream, if you will, of talent that was based on something different than college games and actually city games. And that didn't, there was a part of America that said, no, that's okay, but you know, our guys are pretty good too. They were drivers for the most part that were in their early stock car shows were people that didn't get that top education, didn't go to colleges and so forth. And so from the very beginning, they represented the country. Most of those people were farm people. No matter what state you were in, up here in Vermont, we had 23 tracks. Imagine that, back up here in the woods. But they all ran, and they all had heroes, local heroes, that were theirs. And this was the summation of all of that. Here were those cars we talked about, and driven by people that we thought we knew. And pretty much they were like everybody else. It didn't take on the magic of Indy particularly, but it had its own magic. And it was American with American talent. And they soon learned that on the super speedways. The thing was as dangerous as Indianapolis. And Bill France figured out right off the most important thing. He put the numbers on those cars on the doors, and they were 3 feet high. And you'd be damned if you could read the numbers on those Indy cars as they flashed by, unless you were really onto it and understood it completely. They were just a maze of colors, and heaven help us that we find out who they are. And the stock cars from the short tracks originally, where France started in the southeast, from that area came the kind of identity with America and with folks that were lumbermen. Many of them came out of the forest, if you will, working on farms and half the year cutting trees and getting them into the mills. And another whole group that worked just as much in the cotton mills that had moved into the Carolinas. And that was kind of a factory life. And there were people here that just didn't want to assume that role of just being a factory worker. They wanted something a bit more and were willing to pay the price on it. And those became the stock car legends like Fireball Roberts and the Petty family of North Carolina, Level Cross, Kaylee Yarborough from down in South Carolina. Most of them had kind of a tangle of expressions that talked about who they were from where they lived. Banjo Matthews, I guess I don't have to tell you where he came from. But those people really spoke to the kind of folks that wanted that kind of entertainment, and they understood it because everybody had a favorite car. That was a gross national product. I mean, the ads in the newspapers were not for Indianapolis cars. They were for Lincoln's, Chrysler 300s. Name your brand, and France had found a way to get most of them into the racing business in hardtop cars. Originally, many of them were in convertibles. They gave up on that, and I'll never understand completely why. Because actually they seemed safer without a roof. You didn't get trapped in the middle. If anything happened and you rolled over five or six times, you could crawl out, build another, generally speaking. It had everything that America liked, like in football. Dangerous, you bet, and exciting, and always with spectacular action. And it was created by folks that looked like everybody else, your neighbors. And they didn't carry any meritorious messages about universities or colleges. These were working people, and America reacted to it.
Absolutely. Now, Ken, you were the lead broadcaster 1979 to 1997. Now, the one that sticks out for me that you were in the booth for, and Daytona being on television, the Daytona 500 for 40 years now, one of the great moments, you were standing next co-broadcasting with Ned Jarrett, 1993. His son is in a nail biter with Dale Earnhardt to win the Daytona 500, his second race, first Daytona 500 for Dale Jarrett. You're in the booth with Ned. What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember that I was told to shut up. down at the end, of course, Ned Jarrett had never won the Daytona 500, but was accepted and respected as one of the gentlemen of racing. And most of us knew pretty well how far that gentle business went with Ned. He'd won 50 races, and you didn't win those by putting your hand in the air and wishing for things to change. He was a good race driver, consistent, steady, but he never pulled it off. He came close twice. So here's Ned now standing beside me describing this action, and out there is his son, just flying with a wonderful car. And it got down to showtime and the finish, and it was the Dale and Dale show. New young guy out of Kannapolis, North Carolina. That would have been Earnhardt. And the family that was really recognized up there with the Petties, the Jarretts, and those two were hard after that race. So you had all the makings to improve the whole business. So on that last lap, there were the two of them at the end of 400 or 500 miles, and they were wheel to wheel, side by all the old cliches, but it was real, and they were flying. Came down to the end, last two or three laps, and there was no question that those two were going to decide the race between themselves. There might have been 45 or 50 cars in that race. I can't remember. But I do remember that the interest in Jarrett and the interest in the Petty crowd was at its height, and one of them was going to win this event. February every year, when nothing else was going on in motorsports. And here was a 500-mile race, and another time when they were side by side to follow through and finish it. And a voice named a voice named Bob Stenner was the producer of that show. And it, as it continued to build and develop as a feature event of real merit, as you point out, he said, "Ken, lay out and let Ned describe the finish for his driver in this race. Just lay out, say nothing, and let Ned go and see what he can do." And he said, "Ned, call your kid home." And Ned Jarrett lit up American television because he hadn't won that race, and there was his son. And it was just about as perfect a finish as you could ever hope for. And, of course, his son won, and pulled into victory lane. And one of the first things that Jarrett said when he climbed out of that car was, "Ned, Dad, this one was for you and for the one you lost." Pretty good stuff. Mm. You don't find that every day, but you found it that day.
Absolutely. 1993, Daytona 500, not forgettable. Ken, what was your favorite moment as being the lead broadcaster in that nearly two-decade run you had?
All of them.
Mm. Yeah.
I really enjoy stock car racing. Truly enjoy short track American racing, which really gets you back down to the bare knuckles and the real sense of what American motorsports was in those days and hopefully continues for many years to come. It was such a part of America, and it represented such a spirit that was in the United States, and I've said it too many times, but it's really true. It's the story of the everyday guy, the everyday person, who makes the exceptional, whatever it is in his life, works for it, believes in it, does it. The common man doing uncommon deeds. That's Daytona then, still is now. It's been puffed up and prettied and all of that sort of thing. But underneath it all are the Tony Stewarts of the world, and they're hard people. They work hard, they play hard, drive hard, and go down, sadly, sometimes, wide open. And there's nothing else quite like it. A lot of them have some risk, but this is the one where you just set it aside and go for it if you believe in it. And so many Americans do, and those drivers that come along through the years, takes 5 to 7 years to produce a good driver, and they get it down. And it doesn't matter if we're talking about Darrell Waltrip or any name you choose to come up with. In the old days, many of the best names came from the Midwest. Tiny Lund was from Iowa. I can't remember them all here. I hadn't really thought about it. But they were what America was, and they were proud of it, and they did it well. And it honored those who persevered and won the show. It wasn't any qualifying action that would take away from what that final thrust was to win the event. And it wasn't just hitting a tennis ball over a net. It wasn't catching a ball in center field. This was coming through the fourth turn with your tires worn down, the engine ready to fail, run 500 miles and it wouldn't ever run again. It was for everything. And they gave it everything when they went out. There was no holding back. If they had a good car, they had to try and bring it home.
Ken, we've got about 13 minutes left here, and there are a couple things I want to cover. 1997, you left the broadcast booth and went to the in-studio part of the Daytona 500, and then left that in 2000. How did that all come about?
Well, time goes on. New drivers, new teams, new people describing it, pretty natural thing in this country. We know about that. But more important, they found new roles for me. I would become the host, and it gave me a chance to write a few things about how I believed that this was a darn good game and that it was worth the candle. And I was not unhappy about that. I was delighted that they had that much interest, they that were the management. Remember, this is CBS, and they had gotten over their reticence about all this because they found out that a Richard Petty or a David Pearson or a Bobby Isaac or any name you care to mention that had risen through the ranks and were in that race had a story to tell. And it was fun to think that you were part of it and sometimes could tell the story to help the race along. We didn't talk much about tires. We didn't talk except when they came apart. But we talked about those guys. They had a lot to say to us. And people like Bobby Isaac of Catawba, North Carolina, became my hero, and I didn't know him, and he didn't much care for me. I was a damn Yankee from Vermont, and he was from Catawba, North Carolina. And it was a little like Joe Louis. I was once told by the man that wrote the book on the greatest team of them all about the New York Yankees that the best interview he ever had was with Joe Louis. And Joe Louis was heavyweight champion of the world, and everybody said he couldn't talk and made fun of him. But still, he was the Brown Bomber, and he was it. And in this case, it would be Richard Petty or Pearson or Yarborough or the Alabama gang with Allison and company that were up there on top, risking it all, as they used to say on the midways of the short tracks, that were making the difference. And when they talked about, finally, when they broke through, I guess that's the way to say it, they had the best answers about why people do things like that, that to this day most people think are pretty silly. But they did it for a cause. They did it because it was something they believed in and it was something they could do. And so for those farm folks from Virginia, like the great Wood Brothers, for those out of anywhere you'd care to name in Iowa, now you're talking about hometown people, and I love that, still do.
Ken, one of the other moments of the Daytona 500 that has gone down in the history, I want to know where you were when this happened. Of course, Daytona 2001, the death of Dale Earnhardt of all races. For it to take place at Michael Waltrip wins the race. Darrell Waltrip, another moment there. Darrell Waltrip's in the booth. Where were you that day? And take us through what you saw and the emotions you went through being there from the beginnings of television.
Well, that was some day because that was the first event that the name Earnhardt really touched off a match in the imagination of America. Earnhardt was the definitive race driver. He won a lot of races. He whacked a lot of bumpers. He would go through a little, you know, sideways and end up always seemingly in the lead. And there we were with a guy that had proven himself over and over again and chose racing as a way to demonstrate that. Didn't do all the fancy schoolwork. Just worked on cars, built the parts and pieces that would work, and foiled the dickens out of them. And Earnhardt came about, and it was three laps, I believe, or two laps to go. All of a sudden, this guy that had represented everything about racing, good and bad, was up there in sixth or seventh place. But he could look out his windshield, and there he could see the future. There was his son fighting for the win, and alongside of him, Tap for Tap, was another pretty handsome young guy named Waltrip. That was the brother of the Darryl Waltrip that we know and still hear on television. And it was an awareness that no matter how that race finished, that name, Waltrip or Earnhardt, would be strapped to it. As it was, Michael Waltrip won that race. His father had been, and I will always believe that he got it. All of a sudden, the guy who would never give up until the final moment of a race, when it was checkered flag out, was back in the 11th position or 8th, somewhere back in there, and he was cognizant that his teams, one of them would win, and his son had the potential also of winning. And what a great feeling. He had finally conquered the great American race, and there was the future, his kid, up there fighting to win that same race. And I think that he then settled in with some guys that he really liked and loved to race with. And they were duking it out back a ways. But he could still keep an eye on who, which he always did, on those that were fighting for the lead. He was not in it, but he was willing to do whatever he could do to help. And so he fought it out with some of those guys a little further back, and Sterling Marlin was in that crowd, and they had duke outs since the early days up at Nashville. Let's see, who else? There were three or four of them. And he was back there and having a heck of a good time, as much fun as he would have had if he had been there battling with his son against one of his own cars. And that, for a moment, was about as good as life could be for Earnhardt. He had the admiration of the crowd that was there. He had a son who was potentially the winner, and he had developed another race car and another team under the Earnhardt colors, and it was fighting with his son to win the race. Gee, what a moment for a guy who hardly had an education as such, but understood the values and the dollars involved in what racing was and what it might be.
Mm. Where were you, Ken, during that race?
Let's see. I think I was in the booth most of the time, and then I had moved to another position where I could then get to Victory Lane. And so I was there. Got to see the finish and of that race, and also had seen that car of Earnhardt go straight up into the wall, turn four, and it didn't look like anything particularly life-threatening. But within moments, as that race shuddered, it was evident that there was trouble up there. Meanwhile, in Victory Lane, where we were about, here was a very excited Earnhardt team with their driver, Michael Waltrip. And Michael, he's a celebratory kind of guy, was there. And one of the drivers who was up in that with Earnhardt at that point, I saw him start to walk in to Victory Lane, and I thought this was pretty interesting. It had taken maybe 5 minutes. And as the awards were given out and all the blue blah that goes on, saw that he took Michael Waltrip aside and said something to him, which I am sure now was, "It's really bad up there, and Earnhardt's not going to make it. And I just want you to know that before you continue to carry on with all the celebration stuff. because we've lost a good one, and I don't want you going crazy about it, because it's one we all love and like. And I saw Michael sit down on the steps for a moment or two there in Victory Lane, and I knew that he'd been told that one of his great competitors, and he was far younger than Earnhardt, had just had a critical accident up on the track. Well, you know the rest of the story. It became realistic. They took him over to the hospital in Daytona Beach, and he had expired, I believe, just about instantly when that car thrust itself into that concrete wall. And the legend has only grown since. T-shirts down there in Daytona on 2nd Avenue by the next day were saying, "Last lap, last turn, last American hero."
Ken, all these years, 40th anniversary, how would you like the fans of NASCAR to remember you when we're at the 100th televised running of the Daytona 500?
I don't know. I hadn't even considered that. But I know that racing is going to change. And change, as we all know, is good, but it's tricky and it's difficult and hard to imagine. I wouldn't be surprised if by that time came we'd all be in electric cars. That new E-Division that's been running out in the Pacific on the Pacific Rim, they go 200 miles an hour, and they look like Indy cars. That somewhere in there will be another change, and the engine in what is transportation today is going to change, and it will again be always a portrayal of what the civilization is sitting in and trying to get around in. Or it may not be. I keep hearing that we're all just going to sit back and run them like an electric, whatever you call it, those games. It's all going to change, and I think the fun of it is to be part of following that story as long as you can, because the people that do it are so intriguing and so different in most ways than most of the people I know.
Absolutely, and what a pleasure it is today to be with the man who coined the Daytona 500, the Great American Race, and was the broadcaster, the lead broadcaster, back in 1979, 40 years ago, when it went on television. And if you want to watch the 60th running of the Daytona 500, the 40th running on television, it is this coming Sunday, 2 p.m. on the Fox Network. Ken, it's a pleasure to be with you, and I hope we can talk again.
Thank you.
Ken Squire.
Doesn't get any better prior to the Daytona 500. Linda Sims coming up at 4 p.m. today, Mike Wilson at 5, and for now, this is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Main thing is your family and how you treat other people and enjoying